Go ahead and think about the last time when you got hired for a new job because you were already an expert in that thing that they needed. Now I want you to fast forward. You're a few months in at this company where you're supposed to be an expert, but nothing is working the way that you expected. All those things, those playbooks, those wins, those lessons that made you successful at your last company, they're not working here. And there's a lot of pressure. The team is counting on you. The executive team brought you in because of your track record. So what do you do? Do you push harder and hope that maybe some of these things will fit into the new context of this new company? Do you admit publicly that you're struggling and you're not sure what to do and hope that it doesn't tank your credibility? Or do you go back to square one and go through the slow, painful process of figuring out what in the world should you do at this new company to help them solve whatever growth challenges they're facing today, even though publicly that might look like you saying, I don't know what I'm doing here. Now, I see different flavors of this all the time in my coaching practice. And there's almost this mental shift that has to happen as you work through this. You have to stop thinking that the only reason they hired you was because you had all the answers. And instead, remind yourself that they actually hired you because you're the best person to figure out the answers. My guest today worked through this. His name is Baron Ernst. He's a product and growth leader. He spent more than 20 years at companies like Snap, like Booking, like Figure. His LinkedIn looks insane. And in our conversation, he got real about some of the messy stuff along the way in his journey. When his playbooks stopped working, when his values didn't match the company culture, about how he learned to be a leader when he didn't have all the answers himself. All right, it's enough from me. Let's go ahead and hear from Baron Ernst.
I'm originally from Reno, Nevada. I am actually back living here now after leaving at the end of high school. And I think probably what's foundational about growing up here for me in a lot of ways was I love the mountains. I love being outdoors. So it's been actually really nice to kind of return back home to have that inspiration that comes from the access to the outdoors and the mountains and the hiking after a lot of years living in cities. From like a childhood perspective, probably a story that gives you a little bit of a sense for who I was when I was younger. So I was like competitive on the ski team, but at the same time, I guess this is the best way to frame me. Really competitive kid on the ski team who then could get really scared if the course felt off or felt weird. And so one of the interesting things of my personality that I've always had to balance is how do you be as competitive as possible, but also like manage the fear, manage the challenges that come around that. And I think that's a lot of the story of my life is managing kind of like opportunity and competitiveness with the fear of like, will it work? Am I going to be okay? Will I be safe? And it's funny, I think I've spent a lot of my life, both through sports and through other activities, having that as part of my mindset. And I think it actually has come into my career quite a lot as well.
Oh, dude, that's so interesting. As you share that, I feel like I can say that about myself too. Like I grew up a skateboarder, snowboarder, and like you kind of have to live a little dangerously to be good at those things. And I was never that comfortable with like actual danger. And so I was skilled, but like not the most wild. And so that kind of limited me at some point. So it's interesting to hear you describe it in a different way here.
It's very same for very similar for me, which is, it's funny. It's, I feel like a lot of people develop that sense of caution when they're in their 30s and 40s. I feel like I had it somehow when I was like 10 or 11 years old. And it was always this weird balance that I had to strike of how do you be competitive and good at something while also having to manage that fear that's inside of your brain. And you see the people like Alex Honnold and these other people where it clearly doesn't impact them the same way as it impacts me or you or someone else like that. And managing that trade-off, I think, has been a really interesting thing, both athletically, competitively, career-wise, college-wise, et cetera. I just think it's actually frames a lot of my life in a lot of ways.
There's a quote that's going around like my algorithm right now with Alex Honnold. And they're like, oh, how do you manage fear? And he says something like, I think everybody needs to do some scary shit once in a while. And if you don't, your brain will make an average thing scary. And so he actually just said, I actually think managing fear is like the largest part of my life's success because the little things I don't make into big things because I've spent so many times battling the big things. And I've like had to really sit and think about that and think about like at the life that I have today, you know, I got two little kids, like my life is pretty safe these days. And so I've like really had to think about that when things feel big in my mind, if they actually are big and if I need to have like more practice getting scared in my life moving forward.
Yeah. Or you hear, you know, this is an older one, but I remember one of Tim Ferriss's big ones maybe 8 or 9 years ago was do something that makes you uncomfortable every day with the intent. That moment then makes everything else feel not nearly as challenging, I think, in a sense. And I do think that there is something to that for sure.
Well, I think that's why like the cold plunge movement has been so popular. That's like a micro piece of that.
I totally agree. It's funny. I haven't gotten it. I do it. I don't think that I've read all the science. I don't know if it helps, but it's just that moment of, you know, even if it's just 30 seconds of cold shower, it shocks you into some other mindset, which it can be helpful in that way.
And then it releases like that whole body buzz for a little while. And that's the addicting thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And so tell me a little bit more about your childhood. Like, what was the first job that you ever had? Did you have like a paper route? Did you like work as like a ski instructor or something later on? What was the first gig?
First job I ever had was as a pier attendant at a boat dock in Lake Tahoe, which I know sounds amazing. Actually, in order to get the job, I first had to do trash duty for about a month up there. So I had to walk the entire grounds of this condominium complex and pick up trash until they said, okay, now you're ready to be a pier attendant. And being a pier attendant, and this was in the 90s, involves the following: sitting on a pier, taking people to their boat, helping people bring their boat to the dock, and then just sitting on the pier for a bit longer. And keep in mind, this is a time when no iPhones, nothing. So quite a lot of time spent staring at the water, reading a book. There's no Wi-Fi, nothing really. So it was, I'd say, a time of a lot of reflection and then just waiting and then hoping someone was going to want to take their boat out, and then crazy rushes in the morning and in the evening. But it was actually a really good job in a lot of ways because I wouldn't call it particularly hard. I had some more, we'll call them challenging jobs prior to my actual career, but it was a very good entry level type of thing because at a minimum, the picking up trash part was really annoying. I did not enjoy doing it, but it was sort of a good rite of passage to get to the pier attendant job, which everyone viewed as the great summer job that you could get. And it was wonderful and boring at the same time is the best way I could describe it, which is funny. It's like for most people, they'd be like, that sounds like the greatest job of all time. And it was incredible for a 15-year-old, but also weirdly, like all of the buildup I had from seeing all these guys that who had been doing it since I was a kid, I got doing it and I was like, there's a lot of downtime just sitting around on this pier. So, yeah.
I can imagine what that is. My dad has like a little sailboat. I forget the term of like the size sailboat that he has, but it's on, there's someone who's at the dock that has like a little small motorboat that takes you out to the boat and then drives the boat back and makes sure you have life jackets. And I can imagine that exact job.
Yeah, it's basically a valet for boats is the best way to think about it. Is your job is to take people to and from their boats all day, hopefully make them happy, try to make them smile. Some people are going to be cranky. Some people are going to be in a good mood. And, you know, similar to a valet, you're just trying to be as nice as possible to work for tips. So because you're a minimum wage kid, essentially. Yeah. And so it was actually from that perspective really interesting because you did have to learn how to do like good customer service and learn from the other people, you know, hey, this person's going to be a bit mad every day and this person's going to be happy and this is a good tip or this is a bad tip. And so it was all that weird social dynamic that you got to learn at an early age, which I think was actually really valuable.
About a year ago, I had the opportunity to coach this amazing guy named Philip. He was the head of growth for a pretty large subscription business. They were Series A on their way to Series B when he and I worked together. And he was an incredible guy, but relatively new to the head of growth role and relatively new people manager. And so a lot of what he and I worked on together was creating a team of A players, hiring them, putting the right team structure in place to support his growth goals, and what it looked like day to day, week to week to manage that team. And he had a big team. He had 12 US-based team members and another 25 overseas contractors on his team doing all of this different specialized execution work. That ended up being a huge lever for him. Fast forward to today, Philip co-founded a business called Hire Overseas, helping other teams find, hire, train, and manage exceptional overseas talent based on the experience that he had in his previous role, which is pretty cool. So if you're looking to bring on some amazing talent in 2026, check out Hire Overseas. It's built by a member of our tribe, former head of growth. Its co-founder also comes from the startup marketing world, and they can help you find amazing folks to join your growth or marketing team. You can hire growth marketers, paid ad folks, SEO, designers, content creators, dozens of other roles. Check them out for yourself at hireoverseas.com/value. It's hireoverseas.com/value. This episode is presented by Nevatic. If you've been following me or you're a fan of this show, you know how bullish I am on the interactive demo space and how much I love the Nevatic team. I've done a ton of stuff with them over the years, and they just dropped a bunch of new features that are really exciting. First, they've got a new template library. You can choose from a bunch of pre-made templates that have the most common demo use cases and all of the best practices built in, help you go 0 to 1 in a few seconds. If you're not sure what to build, they also have a new AI storyboard generator. It's exactly how it sounds. You drop in a website URL or some copy or a landing page, whatever you've got, it reads the information, pulls out the key sections, and then builds a working product demo for you in a couple minutes. And after you've built your demo, you'll probably want to use your data as part of your go-to-market approach. They've got a bunch of plug-and-play demo playbooks where you can send that interaction data to your CRM. You can use it to trigger alerts, all kinds of good stuff. It's actually a bunch of the things that my team built manually. It took us forever when I was in-house. So I love this. And after you've built your demo, if you need to make any adjustments, if you're displaying numbers or data as part of that, they have a new table AI feature, which helps you to clean up that data in a more conversational way and at scale in just a few seconds. They have made it so stinking easy to use your product as your marketing tool without needing an engineer or heavy design work. You can get started with all of this in their free plan. Check it out at nevatic.com/value to get started. That's nevatic.com/value. And so if we were to go back in time, we meet that 15-year-old version of yourself. What did you think you were going to grow up and become?
I was not even 15, probably through about 21. So my junior year in college, if you'd asked anyone or you'd asked me, I was going to law school. So I was a competitive debater for all 4 years of high school and all 4 years of college. Went, did a internship on Capitol Hill for my local congressperson, you know, in the summer of my junior year, between junior and senior years of college, had done mock trial in high school and was very sure that being a lawyer was the path that I was going to go on. It was sort of the path that most of the other folks in debate took. And I don't know, this is probably the natural extension. Sometime during my senior year of college, had a realization of, I don't really think I want to take the LSAT, and I'm not really even sure I want to become a lawyer, which somehow led to the career path I'm on, which we could talk more about. But this was not planned, I think is the point. This was very much a total circumstantial, random foray that somehow ended up with me in tech for the last 20 years.
That's kind of amazing. And as a quick side note, do you think being a competitive debater has been helpful to you professionally?
I'm actually really glad you asked it. It's probably the most valuable thing I did in both high school and undergraduate. Because when I look back at, like I said, I don't think my career path has been very well planned. I don't think that it's been well structured, but most people would say, oh, but you seem so structured and so put together. And I'm like, I may seem that way. But a lot of that comes from the fact that debate trains you to be able to make these like split quick decisions in the moment, to be able to react, to be able to take either side of an argument. And also it's just a very good critical thinking skill. And the other big thing is the debate version we do in college, the topic can change every single round. So you have to be super up to date on what's happening, what the other team will do, what their strategy is going to be. So if you just think about all the vectors that it enables, you know, thinking about who am I having a conversation with, thinking about what people in the room are going to react to, thinking about how are they going to counter my argument for whether it's a product I want to build or a debate I'm trying to have, that mindset relative to everything else I learned. And I went to Berkeley, did an econ poli sci degree. The debate by itself, I think, is the skill I come back to by far the most of any skill that I learned in college and high school or even before that.
I've had enough folks on this show that I would consider very successful or high performers. And a good chunk of them have done debate when they were younger. And if you think about it, a huge part of the leadership journey is convincing folks that your opinion is the right one when there may not be a clear and obvious answer. And helping them to understand your perspective and explaining it and navigating some of the dynamics and being okay under pressure and all that. I've probably had 10 different people on this show that have shared a version of that. And so it's like enough there that I wasn't into debate as a kid, but with my son who's 5 years old, when he gets older, I'm going to encourage just because I've seen it.
Yeah, if you can get him to do it, it's great. It's also going back to what we talked about at the beginning, debate was a good way for me to also sort of scratch that competitive itch without feeling like I had to risk my life and limb in a lot of ways. And so it satisfies, you know, two different needs for me. One was everything you just talked about. It makes you really good on your feed, really able to respond in real time. And those skills are super valuable, stuff that would be awesome for your son. And then at the same time, for the competitive set among us, which is probably a lot of people on your podcast, it gives you that juice that you need if you're not getting it elsewhere. So it's kind of nice in that sense.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And so eventually you move away from sort of the law path. You move into product management. Looking at your LinkedIn, like, dude, your LinkedIn is ridiculous, right? You work your way up the product management career ladder, head of product a couple times. Someone like you doesn't need to come on this show and to like air out some of your mistakes and the lessons and the missteps and the feedback and all that stuff. Why in the world did you say yes to coming on here?
I really like what you're doing with the show. And I think it's actually really healthy for people to talk about the stuff that didn't go well in their career, because it's so easy for everyone. It's like this, looking at a person's journey, I think, is looking similar to looking at a successful company's journey, right? Like I know this is a tired example, but if you go back and you read the Airbnb example, it's like, it was up and to the right, like nothing happened, until you look at what happened for 4 years before and there was just nothing going on. There was no signal. And if you look at most companies, that's the journey. And I think it's similar with people, right? There's an assumption of, oh, this person was just smarter than everyone. They were just better than everyone. They just knew what to do. And that's not true. The reality is, any of us who've made it to some career level, head of product, CPO, head of growth, CTO, whatever, probably had some really difficult stuff to deal with. And I think sharing it with other people is the only way you really get improvement there. And I think also, we need a little more vulnerability in tech these days. And so I think it's actually useful for people to actually be vulnerable and explain like what worked and what didn't, to help other people get ahead as well.
That's a cool perspective. What I have realized is that you kind of don't learn that much if you only won and it only goes up and to the right, because usually the path to figure shit out is actually how you learn the skills that end up being more valuable in the future. And I actually get a little nervous when people have only like one and it only looks like they've batted 1,000%, because it means they haven't worked through the real stuff that you need to work through at 99% of companies that are in the world. Like most of the companies in the world aren't the Airbnbs, right? And even the Airbnbs, when you make it to that scale, went through a bunch of the shit beforehand. And so going through the shit and learning how to deal with this stuff, to me, is actually the most important things that you can do, even though it doesn't feel fun in the moments.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying this episode of the show. If you are, please don't forget to hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening on. The data shows something like 40% of the people who listen to the show are actually subscribed. It is the best way for you to support the show, and it helps the algorithm find other listeners who are just like you. If you're feeling generous, a quick rating or review makes a huge difference as well. Thank you so much for listening and for your support. Now let's get back to this episode. Dude, so let's get into it. So one of the things that I hear about all the time in my coaching practice are folks who are kind of going through this transition from being A player individual contributors to now figuring out, how in the world do I run a team of other A players, and how do I kind of shift my identity there and kind of pull myself out of the work and enable and delegate and all that kind of stuff. I'm curious for you, if you can describe a time when, maybe early in your leadership journey, when the way that you were leading or managing your team, maybe your instincts weren't right. And so the things that you were doing kind of weren't working and you were maybe trying to work your way through it. Any of that come to mind in your career journey that you've had to work through?
Yeah, totally. So basically my third job was a company that I co-founded with a few friends called Rewarder. And Rewarder at the time was, it's a two-sided marketplace where we were trying to connect people who wanted advice on travel, technology, auto, with people who could help. So think of it as, there's a bunch of 20 to 25 year olds who may have a bunch of knowledge. Maybe some older people would happily pay for their time to help them set up their iPhone or their router or something along those lines, which 10 years ago, 13 years ago, seems like actually a great idea. Now you would just query the AI and you'd be fine. But this was pre those days. So it was really, for me, I had been prior to that an IC product manager. I'd been a director of product at a startup. But this was really the first time where, as a founder, I was also the VP of product, and it was my job to manage the entire roadmap for the team. And you know, small team. We had a couple of PMs on the team, and you know, maybe 20 people. But I think the biggest change for me was coming to the realization that I did not need to be the person who shipped and got involved with every single feature that went out. So a good example, we were trying to improve the way that people submitted questions directly into our experience. And I had this clear idea that, hey, if we do it exactly this way with this exact flow, and I pretty much insisted that the team work through it exactly how I'd asked versus giving them some trust, that it would work. We could get it out in a couple of weeks and it was going to dramatically improve everything because I was completely sure that I was the person who knew exactly how this was going to work. And mistakes that I made along the way was one, you know, I was getting feedback from a few of the PMs that, hey, I don't think this is actually going to solve the problem that you're talking about. Two, what we think was going to be a week or two of work is actually probably a little bit longer, like more like 3 weeks. And so you're actually making a bigger investment to build this feature without validating it than you're assuming. But, you know, in my head, it was like, well, I'm VP of product. I have to show strength. I have to show that I know what's going on within the context of the roadmap and doing all those things that I used to do as an ICPM are maybe not as important because it's on me to have the vision at this point in my career. And I'm sure you can figure out where the story goes. We build the thing, we ship it, and it turns out that we actually are hurting conversion rather than improving it because I have, instead of sticking to my instincts, trusting the team, talking to the customer, really thinking deeply about the problem, I fell into this mindset that as you go up the ranks, you need to become kind of the center of proof and the center of attention, not attention, but you know, like where the mindset comes from, because I think I was modeling it off of what I thought other founders would do or other heads of product would do. And I think the realization is, well, two, one, what gets promoted externally in terms of this person was a visionary and they knew all these things, like true in the case of people like Steve Jobs and those folks, for the majority of us, we probably are not a visionary. We probably are establishing a vision based upon the data available to us. And the moment that you stop taking that data in to establish that vision as a product leader or even as like a director of product, that's the minute that you're dropping some of the most valuable context you're going to have when it comes to actually doing that part of the job. And then the second piece is trusting in the team. And for me, it was really my second time managing a team. And so for me, a big part of the learning was figuring out the level of trust to have in each different person on the team. You know, of course, like the most junior person, you maybe don't put as much stock into what they're giving you feedback on, but when you're getting it from a circle of people at different levels of seniority who are all giving you very similar feedback, it's on you as the leader to take that in and then really adjust your behavior. And I think I just was so junior at the time that I hadn't fully grokked how that was all supposed to work. So for me, good lesson was one, you know, back to the customer, always think back to the customer. It's not about building consensus with the team, but it's taking their data and using it to help you make the best decision possible. And also realize you're not a visionary necessarily. A lot of times the visionary in a lot of us comes from stitching together lots of pieces of data, stitching together our shared experiences. Most of us are not going to invent the iPhone. Most of us are going to build really good products that are metric focused. And I think that's another part of it is figure out what, like for me, it was a big moment of figuring out like what I was good at. I'm really good at operational stuff. I'm really good at moving the process forward. I may not be the best at like the grand 10-year vision. And I think that's okay. I think it's important for people to learn that as they go through the progression in their career.
Is this when you were like player coach? Like I know that you're saying, you know, I was founder at this time, but it sounds like you had a small team, but probably you were still kind of doing some of the work yourself.
I was still very much doing the work. And I think actually that's always been the case with me. I not micromanaging, but I the way I like to think about my role is player coach. But basically when I think about it, when I have a new person on my team, and I've had teams from, you know, three or four people up to 50, 60 type thing. But I think the role evolves, but the thing that's always been true to me is for the people who directly report to me, my job is to figure out, I've always used the analogy of swimming in a pool. So if there's a deep end and a shallow end, my job is throw everyone into the deep end and then figure out, are they capable of swimming there? And if they're not, at what level of depth can they actually swim? And the reason I use that analogy is like, if I've got to be with them in the shallow end, then I'm going to be much more player than coach. If they're really like competitive and, you know, they could swim laps, like they don't need me to be in the pool with them. They just need me to be like on the sidelines holding the timer to let them know how their times are doing. And so for me, I've always used it to try to moderate, like, how much involvement do I need to have with specific people? In this particular case, yeah, I was very much involved day to day with the team, and probably more than I may have needed to be because it was so early in my career where I was learning how to create that, the right level of management oversight, not too much micromanagement, but enough involvement that the person feels like they've got someone helping them, but not overanalyzing and just being on top of them at all times.
I think the new director is like the toughest career point because all of your identity is tied into doing the work and like shipping stuff and crossing things off the list. But now you've got some people that report to you. But for most of us, we didn't really get trained on how to manage them. And so you learn kind of trial by fire and you're still like doing some stuff and you can't possibly catch up to all the things that need to be done. You haven't learned how to delegate. And so for a lot of us, we end up in this place. If you were to read the manager books, they would call that meddling, which sounds worse than it is, but you take a superior, you know, your superior domain knowledge and you use that to influence what people do or don't do versus letting them figure it out themselves. It seems like a lot of our intuition and like muscle memory hurts us right at this stage. And that's kind of what I'm hearing you describe a little bit here. You kind of went through this tough transition and kind of working your way through it and learning some of the leadership skills probably over time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's totally correct. And I agree with you. I think one of the biggest jumps that people make is exactly the one you described, either from that senior PM, principal PM to director or group PM, if it's a bigger organization. That's oftentimes where, and I'm sure you've seen this too, but when I've had people who I mentor, that's a lot of times where a lot of the mentorship happens because then it's about helping someone understand that your time is not entirely your own anymore. Job number one in that role a lot of times is make your team successful and make them be better than you over time. But your natural instinct is they're not as good at doing the thing as I am, so I'm going to do the thing. Yeah. And all that's really doing to your point is it holds you back. It's, you need to use those as, yes, up front, it may take a little bit more time, those teachable moments. But making, it's the classic, like make the investment up front, teach them how to fish versus give them a fish type of thing.
Yep.
Because once you're training them and teaching your team how to do that stuff, you find that you put in a month of harder work so that you get 12 months of easier work or more focused work where you can add more incremental value is what I've always found. Is doing that upfront to train people to really up-level them so that you feel good about their output. A, they're happier because they learn skills. You're happier because you don't feel like I got to check every data pool or every requirement that this person wrote. And you can spend more time thinking about what's the strategic vision versus having to be so involved in the day-to-day. And I think getting to that is hard, but the progression is really important for people as they kind of go through it. And so that's a long-winded way of saying I completely agree with your hypothesis. And I've seen it a lot.
So if you could go back in time and give some advice to your former self and maybe someone listening to this who's in the messy middle of this, what would you say?
I'd say like, figure out the things that you want to hand off to someone and then figure out, do you have the right people where with some training, with some skills, you think you can actually up-level them to do that stuff? And I think the other one I would say is, just because you may be the best at a particular skill, this goes back to like old school capitalist principle, ask yourself, just because I'm the best at something, is it the most effective use of my time? Good example, right? Like if you came from customer service and you have a bunch of tickets that are coming in and this CS team is like underwater, sir, there might be sometimes where you need to jump in and help answer those tickets. A better way to potentially solve it is think about how you could train people on your product team to use that as a way to get feedback and input. And I'm using it just as a basic example, probably because I've been helping out answering customer service tickets lately. It's probably not the optimal use of my time, but it's also the kind of thing that doing it and then showing other people that it's part of the job and something that they should be doing as well, I think sets the right example. So that would be the second one I was going to go to is don't feel afraid to get your hands dirty with tasks that sometimes you would think of as this is not a great use of my time. if for no other reason than to set the example for the team that you're willing to dig into that kind of stuff. And I think that's different than micromanagement. So what I'm not saying is like you're sitting on top of people doing things. What I actually think is there's oftentimes these tasks that people will just put off and put off. If you as the leader can actually jump in and provide the example to them that you're willing to do it, it creates that pathway where everyone else is more willing to do it. And that's everything from running data, running SQL, looking at experiment results. Like, be involved with the team. Just don't be like telling them how to do it. Like, be there to give them proactive, constant feedback. And I've found that that level of engagement has worked really well for me in my career, where I'm not like telling them what to do, but I'm giving them advice or thoughts or trying to provide the right example so that they know where we're trying to get to over time.
Hey, real quick, if you've been enjoying this episode, I'm going to take a wild guess that you're a marketing, product, or growth team lead, which is also my background. And when I first started leading my very first growth team, I have never been more stressed and worked harder and longer in my career because I didn't really have the right system in place. I said yes to everything, and suddenly I was in every single meeting and all the decisions were flowing through me, and I still had my own individual contributor workload on the side. And eventually, I stumbled into something that I now call my growth operating system. It's basically a plug-and-play framework with templates and rituals and how to structure meetings and how to create and document your strategy so that your team can move faster, you can run more experiments, you can win more without you being the bottleneck. So if any of that sounds like you and you're looking for some support, check out my growth operating system at deliveringvalue.co/OS if you want to have more impact and influence without working around the clock. It's deliveringvalue.co/OS. I'd love to hear what you think. For anyone listening to this, one book that's been really helpful for me in learning how to do this more effectively as a leader and as a manager is like the classic Andy Grove, High Output Management.
Absolutely.
The majority of the book is okay, but there's a section that like I can almost close my eyes and recite it word for word. It's when he talks about task relevant maturity, which is the idea that you've got all these people that are on your team that have different levels of experience, and you can manage them based on the experience they have at the given task that they're focused on in the moment. And that there isn't a thing as someone who needs to be totally hands off or someone who you have to totally be leaning in and rolling up your sleeve with. The best thing you can do as a manager is work on the skill of identifying for the task that this person's working on, how much experience do they have? And then adjust your management style accordingly. Folks that have a lot of experience need less from you. They need a thought partner. Folks that have no experience need a ton from you, or else they're not going to be able to get started. So yeah, just a quick plug for anybody listening to this. It's been super helpful for me.
I'll throw Built to Last in there as well, from the perspective that I know it's more about company building, but one of the principles from that I've always held to is at some point, and I know maybe what I just said didn't sound like this was my goal. At some point, my goal has always been to make myself as redundant as possible within the team. And the reason I've always strove for that is that if I can leave and the team will still continue to function, then I think I've actually done a good job. Whereas the alternative of the team needs Baron to function is not a good outcome. That actually means that I have created myself as too central of a cog in the context of the team. And so both figuring out what everyone's good at and then finding the ways to continue to elevate them as a combination, I think is a super important thing for leaders to figure out. And also to realize that you shouldn't feel uncomfortable not doing everything. It's like so counterintuitive, but it's actually like if the team's running well and you have a day where you literally have nothing to do because the team is running well, take that as a win. That means you should spend that time thinking about, what are we going to work on next? What are the other opportunities? Like, use that headspace. But for a lot of people, they would view that as, oh my God, the team doesn't need me today. I must have done something wrong. And I actually like to reframe it as, if that's the case, you may have actually done you hopefully have done something right where they're functioning and doing great without you, giving you that extra time to actually think about like what's next in the roadmap versus being in the day-to-day.
I chat with so many folks that ask the question that you asked yourself out loud, which is, well, what's my value if the team doesn't need me? Like, why don't they just let me go if they don't need me to run? But yeah. Really what you're saying is your job as a leader is really to think longer term. You shouldn't be thinking 0 to 6 months, depending on your level of senior. You should be thinking much longer term. And so finally getting your team to the point where they can operate without you frees up that space, which is so
absolutely
important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know, as a side note, Elena Luneva? She's in the product management space. Do you know her?
Yeah. She and I actually did a speaking course in the fall, but she's continuing to do those and she's still doing a lot of the coaching stuff.
And she's on Maven. Yeah, I figured you would know her. So I had her on this show and she told this story about this insight that she got where she was used to always being right. And she would show up and, hey, I've done the analysis. I think this is the right, or I know that this is the right answer. Here's what we should do. And she talked about this transition in her life and in her career where she learned to go from being right to being effective. So I'm curious for you in your journey, if you go through a similar realization.
I think the biggest thing that I've had to kind of learn over time is the way I like to look at my career is it's like a series of frameworks that I've learned from a lot of the jobs I've worked at. And in my head, I'm always like, if I can figure out, you know, one Kings Lane where I worked, I was running email. So it's like, okay, well, if I can take the framework from what worked really well in email and in growth there and apply it to the next company, that's going to work really well. Or I've done a lot of viral experimentation, sign up work, et cetera. And I'm like, I could just reproduce the same set of experiences and it'll work. I think one of the bigger eye-opening moments within the context of growth and product building was I lived in Europe for about 7 years and went to work for a company that most people have not heard of, even though it's like a $130 billion market cap, called Naspers Prosus. And I ended up being the chief product officer for one of their portfolio companies called Showmax, which best way to think about Showmax is we were trying to build, and we actually did build, a streaming video on demand, think Netflix competitor in sub-Saharan Africa. And big reason that we did this is Naspers actually owned at the time the only satellite TV company in sub-Saharan Africa, saw, oh, digital's coming, we need to be there before them, all these things like, let's build a digitally native team, let's go out, let's put content online, let's just copy Netflix. And in my brain, I'm saying, okay, I've seen how Netflix grew. They have content. They're using SEO to spread it. They're also leveraging quite a lot of things like trialing and all these things. So I'm like, I can copy this playbook. I can look at what the other players in the space are doing, and I can recreate that. And that all sounds great until the classic first contact with the enemy type thing occurs. And we go to the office in Kenya. So we were launching in South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria. And one of the guys on our team says, so have you ever heard of the movie guy that pretty much everyone uses on every corner to watch entertainment? And I'm sitting there like, what's the movie guy? And so we actually brought one of these guys in. And at the time, the way that most people were getting their content was there was usually one guy in every neighborhood. He had probably the best bandwidth, the best connection that he could get. And he would essentially torrent shows that were being shown in Western media, sell those as DVDs or CDs to people that they could play at home without needing internet access. And then their recommendation engine was the movie guy would see what things they liked and he would tailor the CDs or the DVDs directly for them.
Real quick, which is kind of incredible.
I know. It's an amazing story. Yeah. And he brings in the big book of all the CDs and he's like, well, these are the ones with these shows and these are the ones with these shows.
Yeah.
And also we had a customer of his come in and show us all the DVDs that they had bought. And what's funny is like a lot of this has evolved since then. This is a 6 years old story, you know, so like yeah. Mobile has become much more prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. Like some of these structural things have changed quite a lot, but at that time, there's not a lot of fiber down in the ground. It's probably not going to happen because the infrastructure costs are just so high. And we're all kind of waiting, will mobile data be big enough that it'll actually solve this problem? And meanwhile, people are solving the problem on the ground on their own in a completely novel way. And that's who we're really competing with, right? And so at that moment, I'm like, okay, these playbooks aren't going to mean anything in this environment. It was really a moment where I had to like throw not all the playbooks out, but like really recalibrate my thinking to be about, okay, like I can't just apply the old school growth mindset that I've done in America or the old school product mindset that I've done in the States or even in Western Europe to this. I need to really like get deep and understand what's the normal journey that people are going on. And for many folks at the time, it was, you know, limited bandwidth. If they had good bandwidth at home, oftentimes the way that they were getting content would be they would use Wi-Fi at work or Wi-Fi hotspots. They would need the ability to download and have that content available to them on their device. Or we needed to give some way for them to have a streaming box at home where they could download and save all this content or do bandwidth. Basically, all these things that we kind of take for granted now, but a lot of them were things that we shipped first in that market before anyone else did because of the realization that if we just shipped generic old streaming service to sub-Saharan Africa, no one would be able to use it because relative to the competitor, we weren't actually solving their needs at the point of the need. So it became this very kind of eye-opening moment of, yes, the playbooks work and they make sense, but you really need to be location specific, context specific. You need to actually spend the time to understand who the customer is. And that really changed our strategy as a company from a growth perspective. We spent a lot less time worrying about referral, direct marketing, those kinds of things. Worked much more with the telcos in the space who had data, where we could arrange data relationships and all those sorts of things. And because of it, you know, Showmax actually is and continues to be a very successful product in sub-Saharan Africa. But I don't think, had we not taken that approach, I don't think it would be that way. I think we would just be a competitor that fell off to the side because we didn't realize what was actually happening in the market.
The details of this story obviously are ultra specific to you and the experience that you've got. But there's a ton of folks who've been hired into roles. They get a few months in and they realize, shit, all that stuff I learned isn't probably going to work here, or at least it's not going to plug in one-to-one. And they feel a little nervous and unsure and maybe a little bit of like, well, what am I doing here? Geez, why did they hire me? Am I going to get fired? And what is my value here? And did you have, I don't want to project here, but did you have any of those feelings, if we could go back that 6 years in time, to the moment when you realized like the playbooks that they hired me to set up aren't really going to cut it here? I got to do something different.
Definitely. I mean, not just from a like, will they fire me or hire me? I mean, the interesting thing was, just from a dynamics perspective, most of the, even the team dynamic was pretty unique in this context. So I'm kind of been brought over to Europe as this person who had Silicon Valley experience, has been plugged into this company, and who is supposed to solve all of the problems. Most of the rest of the team was a combination of, we had a really, really strong development team in the Czech Republic, or I think it's Czechia now, that we had brought on. And then primarily South African team. And so they're all kind of looking at like, well, they brought this American, he's supposed to know growth things, and he's apparently very experienced. And then I'm sitting here coming up with tactics that they're all looking at me like, dude, this isn't going to work in our market. And so it wasn't just like I was doubting myself, but there was also cultural influence where a lot of them were saying, you don't understand how Africa works. And also I'm trying to ingratiate myself to this Czech development team who is sort of staring at me like, why should we listen to this guy? Who is he? And so I think there was a ton of uncertainty within my head. And, you know, so I, on one side, I'm trying to figure out what's the market, what's the context, how do I actually even come up with a framework that works here? And on the other side, there was a lot of me just thinking about, how do I build the right relationship with people who understand this market? How do I make sure that the engineering team doesn't think that I'm just some idiot who they brought from the States? So absolutely, it was very, you know, it was a really interesting and challenging part of my career. You know, like, just share a very quick anecdote. Myself and the CTO, who are now very good friends, like, we did not get along for the first year, largely because he was a very senior, like, PhD Czech developer who was really widely respected in the Czech Republic, but who would probably not be well known outside. And I'm brought in as this blah, blah, blah growth person. And I think from his perspective, he's looking at me like, who are you and why should I care, right? He's this incredibly intelligent, smart guy. To get us on the same page, like, we literally went on, this is going to sound sad, but like, we went on a safari at one point in Kenya. And honestly, like, 3 or 4 days where we just had to like hash our stuff out in the bush, while looking at lions, was what it literally took for us to get on the same page as coworkers. And to be clear, we paid for the safari ourselves. It was not a company thing, but like, we both were going to go, and it turned into our head of business development forcing the two of us to like sit down and work our stuff out. And that was incredibly valuable. And I know this is a little bit off tangent from the original story, but it's the same experience from the same company. And a lot of that doubt and a lot of that having to prove myself really came back through that experience, where for the first year I was like, do I even have any idea what I'm doing? And having to reestablish and rebuild those relationships and also build some sort of a playbook that would work was a big part of going through that, for sure.
Like, man, I don't want to go on this safari with this fucking guy. I'm trying to relax and have a good time here.
Well, pretty much, exactly. It was, you know, and I know that sounds like a luxury problem, which 100% it is, but it was like, you know, both one of the greatest vacations and also one of the most stressful, because I'm sitting there like, this is this thing I've wanted to do my whole life. It was the only time I ever had gone. And then at the same time, I'm like, but this person's going to be on the trip who I don't really know if I like. And now I've got to deal with them for 3 days with no internet in the middle of nowhere. But it was weirdly the right thing to have happen. And I actually did take a principle from it. And the principle is sometimes for the leadership team to just get on the same page, you got to just send them somewhere away from everything for some period of time and make them sit down and work through their stuff. Not have an offsite about vision and strategy and other stuff. Just have an offsite where it's about how do we work together? What are our problems? And like just air it out. And I actually think there's a lot of value to that. And I think it's something we don't do enough in reality because it's uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable, but, and I think this is the point of your podcast, those moments of discomfort are where we actually grow the most.
Yep.
And I think a lot more of that is probably needed in a lot of companies.
Hey, if you're enjoying the stories on this show and feel like you're ready to tackle some of your own hurdles, I'm here to help. If you didn't know already, I offer one-to-one coaching specifically for people who work on or around growth teams who want to have a bigger influence and impact in their roles. Maybe you're navigating some tough moments, whether it's managing your team or handling feedback. Maybe you just want to step into a bigger leadership role. Or maybe you're at a unicorn company today and you want to make sure that the company doesn't outgrow your skill set. Either way, I can help. If you're interested in learning a little bit more, head to deliveringvalue.co/coaching to learn a little bit more and set up a call with me to see if we jive. All right, enough from me. Back to the episode. When I think about the moments, like the real moments in my career that are step changes, it's usually right after like the most uncomfortable conversations.
Yes.
Like the ones that you're nervous about, that you have to like prep for, that you're like Googling, how do I do this kind of thing? When you get on the other side of that, usually that's when the good stuff happens. But the only way through it is to shine a light on all the shit that you're trying to avoid shining a light on. And that's been true for me too. So that checks.
What's the quote? The only way around is through.
It's so true. And there's a book about it too, right? It's like, I forget what the book is called, but it's something like hard is the answer or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's true. You know, sometimes it's like your natural instinct is like, I don't want to walk into that cave.
Right. That's not going to be fun. And it's not.
Yeah, it's not. But you have to deal with it because otherwise you're never going to get to the other side and you're never going to get through that point. And it, like you said, that's when the growth actually happens.
Yeah. There's also a really interesting, another interesting takeaway from your story for me. I chat with a bunch of folks who are in new jobs that have always been the expert, that are hired in to be the expert. And then they realize that their expertise isn't going to plug in one-to-one, just like the story that you were telling us. And there's almost like this frame shift that has to happen where they didn't hire you. This is what I tell a lot of folks. I'd be curious if this checks with you. But what I usually say is they didn't hire you because you know the answer. They hired you because you're the right person to figure out the answer. Like that's your value. Your value isn't the stuff you've learned. It's the process that you learned it, that you can apply to a million different problems. And you're the best person to figure that stuff out. But that's easy to say with hindsight. And in the moment, sometimes we put a lot of that pressure on ourselves.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's also a natural human instinct, which is what are humans good at? We're good at pattern matching. And so naturally what we default to is this like a thing I have seen before? And I think that there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually a natural instinct because you're just trying to get to the right solution as quickly as possible. The key is part of it to what you're saying is to question those assumptions that there is a pattern that matches somewhere along that line, right? I think where the mistake gets made is assuming a pattern match, but then like, you know, it's like a 40% match or a 50% match versus an 80 or a 90% match. It's like, you really should have some sort of, I don't like to have it, there's like a specific rubric for it, but it's like, there's some level where you have to tell yourself, hey, like, this is not the pattern I'm used to. Therefore, what assumptions do we need to start questioning to really figure it out?
Right. I need to go back to the beginning and not just jump to the third base or whatever. Yeah.
And that's also part of the pattern, I think, as well for people is if you pattern out when you go back to first base to start thinking about it, that could be part of the framework as well, right? Mm. Like, I mean, I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't think about is they're like, well, my frameworks all don't work anymore. I better throw them out. Part of your framework can be if at this point nothing matches my existing frameworks, then this is the framework. And that framework is go back to square one, do customer discovery, think about who your customers are, talk to your coworkers who've been there, who understand the market, right? And so for those of us who love to think in patterns and frameworks, it's not mutually exclusive. Like, you can actually do both in this context if you think about it in the right way.
So in addition to being in these circumstances where you realize your initial patterns and your initial assumptions aren't a perfect match, those are times for me where my confidence has taken a hit. I'm curious for you, what's been another time where in your career, you felt like you took a little bit of a step back or you took a little bit of a blow in terms of your confidence? It could be some feedback or a public setback, a difficult conversation. What comes to mind for you as I ask that question?
So one of my roles, I was head of product, VP of product, and also sort of running quite a lot of other roles within the context of the company. So it was a bit of a more junior team in some senses. I actually, weirdly, was, I think, one of the most senior people brought in on this particular startup. And because of it, I had quite a lot of responsibility. But we had a very, I'd say, super strong, very talented CEO and founder, but who had a very different, I'd say, approach to feedback, to radical candor, which was a big principle of his, than I did. And what's funny is we had both read the book. We both interpreted it in entirely different ways. So I interpreted radical candor as give honest and direct feedback to your team, but give it to them in a space that is where they're ready to receive the feedback, where they can actually do something with it from an actionable perspective, and it's something that you can work with them directly on. He viewed it as candor was kind of required at all times and in all contexts. And so it was a very, and I'm not actually sure which is the right interpretation. I'd like to believe mine is correct, but it doesn't matter, right? At the end of the day, it's a work of, you know, it's not a work of fiction, but it's a work of advice, essentially, and people can interpret it however they want.
As a quick side note, so I've read the book twice. Yeah. I had different book clubs at different companies that like read it and discussed it. And I would say on average, not always, but on average, most people way over course corrected and were just jerks for a while. And they would literally say, I knew they were going to be a jerk when they'd say, hey, can I share some radical candor? And I'm like, you're not doing it. You're not doing it right. You should have to do it that way. If you're doing it the right way, you're about to say something mean and you just did that to frame it up. And so I saw a lot of people read that and interpret it differently than I certainly did. And then eventually settle somewhere in the middle.
I think I interpreted it probably more similarly to what it sounds like you interpreted it as, not as, I think some people interpreted it as the title is Radical Candor and therefore that is what I will deliver. But if you actually read the nuance of it, I did not get that as the nuance.
They focused on radical. We focused on candor.
Exactly. That's a great way to frame it, actually. I've never thought about it that way, but that's entirely correct. So this created the situation where we were doing weekly product reviews with one of which is different teams. And my methodology had always been, prior to that, when I do a product review with the CEO and the executive team, my job is, this is a general principle I have, which is, if you're going to do a review with my boss, my leadership team, and you're on my team, we should make sure that you and I, if you were my direct report, Andrew, not that you are, but let's just pretend, we should get aligned prior to the meeting such that I can back you up and provide the support you need. The flip side of that coin for me has always been, if you go into the meeting without prepping me, then, you know, that's kind of on you. But, you know, if you spend the time and put the effort into making sure I'm on board, taking my feedback, getting it in a good shape, then my job is to be your champion in that meeting. The CEO basically told me, he's like, I don't appreciate this, that you're coming to defend them in the meeting, that you all have pre-prepped everything. He sort of said, he's like, I actually believe in a principle of, he called it front stabbing, where essentially, like, the idea is, we need to just give the candor directly in the meeting to different people. And for me, this felt like it did feel like at the time a bit of a betrayal of my team, because the way that I built trust with them was by saying, your job is get me on board. My job is defend you to the rest if we're on the same page. And it kind of created this situation where the CEO and I like had very different ideas of how to run these meetings. And he's the CEO, I'm the VP of product. So at some level, I've got to bend a little bit. And sort of ended up being this kind of bizarre situation of, and I don't know if this was healthy or not, but it was what I created of, I would essentially leave opportunities for me to give feedback to the team inside of these meetings, but I would tell them that I was going to give them the feedback. And so it was almost like I was bargaining with myself and with the team.
Right. And then the feedback's kind of performative almost. Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt like morally fine about it, but I also felt like I was fulfilling the company values. And I'm not really sure if that was good or bad.
Yeah.
It worked. It actually managed to get us through the experience. And actually, we ended up being pretty successful with the product that we were building. But it did scar me for a while, because it was the first time where I really felt like I couldn't build the deep level of trust within my team that I usually try to build. And I think that's one of the big things that I always care about, is like, I want my team to trust that if I tell them I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And if I give them that feedback, it's going to be from a genuine place. And this kind of felt like the opposite, where it was about keeping them more off balance and with the feedback. And I don't have a good like conclusion that I agree with it. It's more that I tried to keep some of my personal moral stance, but modified to the culture a bit. I think the other big learning was just that, you know, that's something I have to just be very careful and looking out for with who I'm working with and which leaders I gel well with. And I think that's just something that people have to learn over time, is like, certain leadership styles work really well with others, and figuring out that confluence. And again, it's actually really hard to figure out in interviews.
No, you can't figure it out. You don't figure it out until it's too late and you're in the seat. And yeah.
That's the challenge. And so a lot of times it's just going in with thinking about, what's the framework I'm going to use? How is it going to gel with that CEO? And maybe asking some of those questions as much as you can up front. But again, to your point, it's so hard to assess going in.
Well, and everybody's on their best behavior in the interview.
I wish there was some good advice for it, but there's not.
Yeah, you could back channel it a little bit, but that's even hard to do. Dude, yeah. Can you take us back to the moment? Like, how did that conversation go? Like, how was that feedback shared with you? Like, was that in your one-on-one? Was it in one of the meetings? Did this person interrupt in the meeting and say, hey, take a step back? Or
no, it was, so the feedback was shared with me in a one-on-one, but you know, there had been very direct feedback given to my team and to others in these sessions. And I sensed that there was quite a bit of frustration. And so I think in the one-on-one, that sort of came up and said, I don't even know if I triggered it. I think it was happening on both sides, but I think it seems like we're pretty frustrated in these calls, like, what's wrong, to figure out kind of like what the delta was. And that was where the conversation started.
And so you kind of get this feedback where the things you'll need to do to be successful in this environment and in this moment at this company might be a little bit at odds with your personal values or your personal operating system, so to speak. So what goes through your mind as you get that feedback? Maybe not in the moment, but after the meeting, when you kind of exhale a little bit, or later when you get a little time and space to reflect on it. Like, is that something that you stew on? Is that something that you let go quickly?
No.
What goes through your mind?
I'm very much a self-avowed OCD person. I'm very sure, because I still think about it to this day, that I probably spent the next like 3 days stewing on this and being like, am I going to stay in this job? Can I stay in this job? And that's just how I am. If you ask my wife, she's like, the amount of time you spend thinking about the trivial things is insane. It's just where my mind goes. And this isn't trivial. I'm not trying to say it is, but this is a non-trivial thing. So it's going to get way more attention in my brain. So yeah, I mean, was I stressed? Did it bug me? Absolutely. For not just days, but for weeks. And it took a lot of me sort of thinking about, okay, how can I feel good about making this work? How do I modify? I think that's how I came up with how do I modify some of this to make it work within the context of the company, but not feel like I'm betraying my principles? That was a big thing I had to think through, because it kind of created this existential question of like, do I just go all in on this strategy? Which I think that would have been the path of least resistance. And I could have gone into just, I'm not going to prep with anyone on my team and I'm going to beat the crap out of them in these meetings, which I just couldn't do. I hate to say it that way. That didn't feel okay to me. So then it led to me being like, okay, like, and remember, I'm working, this is a job that was abroad. I'm working abroad. So I can't just quit, as easy as it might seem. If I'm just like, the principles don't make sense. Like, if I quit, that means I got to come back to the States. I need to leave. We've kind of established a life over in Europe for a 7-year period. And so there was a lot of me questioning, not just, is it the right job? But if I quit, what would happen? And all that kind of stuff. And so I think that journey eventually led to the solution I came up with, which I'm not going to say I really thought was the best solution, but it was what made the most sense in that moment, to be honest.
Obviously, this situation is unique to you, but I think probably there's a lot of folks who are in situations today that are some flavor of what I need to do at this company to be successful might not be what I personally would prefer to do, right? There's people that are working at the AI companies, like, that are being forced to work harder and faster and longer than ever before. There's a lot of cultural pressure for some people to work weekends. Feedback culture feels like it's shifting in real time. There's been some changes in diversity and inclusion initiatives. The list could go on and on and on. Boundary issues, working with founders and early stage teams, things like that. What would be your advice to somebody who's trying to figure out their way through one of those conflicts today?
I don't have perfect advice for this. I don't think anyone does. I think for me, what has helped me in my career in these moments is, this is going to be a bit of a weird answer, but what are the things that ground you outside of work would be probably where my head goes first. And the reason I go there is, like, I always kind of start from the fundamentals of, is this job going to hurt home life, wife, kids, pets, family, etc.? Secondarily, and you know, like, a lot of us are very privileged, right? So be able to ask that question who work in this world. So let me be clear, I'm caveating all that to saying, like, obviously there's the, if you need to pay for stuff, I totally get it. And I'm not saying quit your job, but, you know, ground yourself in, will it fundamentally harm my most important relationships? Then secondarily, what are the things that help me create some sort of mental stability or physical stability on a regular basis? For me, a lot of that's like, I love ski mountaineering and all that kind of stuff. I do that in the morning a lot of days before work. For me, it's a lot of like coming up with what's that routine, what's that pattern that helps me get through that. And then see if those things can bring you calm. And then also then really ask yourself from a perspective, like, am I really crossing a moral boundary that I just don't feel good about? And if so, then what's the alternatives? And if it's really more about time, the amount of effort that is being asked for you to put in, I think you ask a different question at different ages of your career, right? If you're in your 20s and you're being asked to work 996, but it could be life-changing money, like, I think for a lot of people, that might be a trade-off that you have to say, like, I'm comfortable trading off part of my personal life with the expectation that this may open it up big time in the future. If you're more like, you know, you or I, and you're maybe late 30s, 40s, et cetera, and you've maybe had a bunch of career opportunities, and you have a family, you then have to ask yourself a very different question, which is the upside and the money and the effort and the grind worth it relative to what I want to get out of life? And so I always kind of ground it back in, like, what are the goals that you're trying to accomplish? And for some people, it's make net worth number go up. That's never been my goal. For me, it's always been, and especially that you get this right as you get more senior, as I'm sure many have told you before, but as you get more senior, the titles and everything for me matter a lot less than, do I like the people I work with? Am I happy with the team that I'm on? Are we doing something that's interesting? And that's the question that I've gotten the privilege to ask now in my career. But I'd say for a lot of younger people, and this is going to sound like counter to the self-empowerment movement, you may not be able to ask yourself that question until you've got 10, 15 years under your belt, because you do still have to prove a little bit of that to the market and to yourself. And I'm not saying that to be like curmudgeonly or old. I'm just saying it because, like, we all at this stage have gone through some version of that, and there will be pain and there will be those moments that you learn from. And then you figure out, like, what really matters to you. Is it the title? Is it the role? Is it your family? Is it skiing? And I'm not judging any one of those, but figure out what it is for you that gives you that energy, and then figure out, does the job actually relate well to it? I think that's the key question there.
And you were talking about these different chapters in your career. It's funny, thinking about radical candor, one of the things that I took away from that book, she talks about the difference between superstar chapters of your career and rock star chapters. So, like, superstar, leaning in, working harder and longer, gunning for promotions, wanting to take on extra. And then rock star periods still means you're going to be an A player, but it means you might not be at a point in your life where work is the sole focus. So maybe you have a family or a race or an event or a parent you're taking care of, whatever it might be. We all have personal things, but you want to do a great job at work, and then you don't want to be bothered, so you can focus on those other things outside of which. And that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit here in terms of, like, self-diagnosing.
No, that's a great callback. I need to think about relating it back to the book, but now that you said it, yeah, absolutely. That's a totally accurate way to think about it.
Has there been anything we haven't talked about so far in terms of mindset or habits or rituals that have had the big impact on your career growth and your career success?
So I would say the one thing that a lot of people ask me about that I would mention just quickly is one of the things that I've not done is stayed in a particular vertical. If you look at my career, so I've done fintech. I currently work for a golf company. We're building a rewards program for golf courses. You know, I've done social networking, streaming video, et cetera. And people say, what do all those have in common? Because a lot of people, you know, like pick fintech, stay in fintech, pick streaming video, stay in streaming video. I actually think more people would get more value out of more range across the types of roles if they stay within a particular discipline. So I've primarily been product and growth with some marketing for 20 years. Where I have gotten, I'd say, the most development is what we talked about with like Africa, different geographies, different company types, different things. Because what that has forced me to do is, you know, over time you figure out a growth or a product framework that works well for subscription businesses or for SaaS businesses or for streaming video or these different types of things or for e-com or travel. I worked at Booking briefly. But what you don't get if you don't cross industries is what's similar and what's different from the playbook. And to me, that's actually been the thing that I would say has been the most valuable from doing it across a lot of different places is, no, I'm not the deepest expert in one specific industry. But what I've found is because I context switch industries, that actually means that you're faster to get up to speed at something new. And also you have many more patterns that you can match to at a new place than if you just had that one specific slice of experience in a particular vertical. And I actually think more people would get a lot more value out of doing that because it would actually build out their range and their frameworks that they could leverage. Probably this is obvious. I love the book Range and it's big influence for me, but that's always been kind of my mindset is I like to be able to do a lot of different things. And I think the ability to do that comes with changing verticals and not getting pigeonholed into one particular part of tech or product or growth, if it's possible.
And that's one of those books. I've had it on my shelf or I had it on my nightstand. And I don't know why. Maybe it was just when I bought it. It was like during the pandemic. I never read it, man. But now you're inspiring me to go back.
It's one of my favorites. I highly recommend it. I mean, it's also very biased because I read it and I'm like, yeah, this justifies everything I do. So let me be clear. Like, it's not the only path. But I do think that there is a lot of what I appreciate about it is I think the idea that you should be good, not full depth good, but like medium depth good across a lot of things gives you a lot more flexibility, both personally and professionally, than just being super good at one thing. Because when that one thing, I think of it like NFL or NBA athletes, right? When the one thing is gone, what do? And you're kind of like, oh no. But if you're good across a lot of different areas, you're a great example, right? You had a great growth career, but then you were like, but I also have range where I could go into podcasting, I can do coaching, I can do all these other things. And that gives you that variety and that spice. And I think it's easy for a lot of people to assume like I just have to keep going deeper and deeper in my vertical. But the reality is branching out actually opens up, I think, a lot more doors than people give it credit for.
Yeah, that's cool. And even within the growth discipline, you know, I do a decent amount of advising and just seeing the differences between, to your point, like e-com versus fintech versus edtech versus SaaS, which is kind of my background, versus like B2C to B SaaS, the anti-patterns. I guess even in my own career, I think I've undervalued understanding the patterns and then the anti-patterns. And you're right, that is super valuable.
Yeah, totally. I completely agree.
Dude, thank you for coming on, sharing your journey, sharing some of the games, sharing some of the lessons here. For folks who are listening that want to connect more with you, where should we send them? We'll put links in the notes below, but what are the channels and or places where folks can get more from you?
Totally. I do have a Substack at www.baroners.com. I generally just kind of write about experiences and things I've seen, mostly product and growth types of things. If you want to query my Super Me, I think that we have one of those on Super Me as well. And just also LinkedIn is just /in/Baroners, but not a whole lot of places, but always happy to connect with folks through all those different channels.
Thanks for coming on, dude.
Thank you, Andrew. Really appreciate it. It was great.